what forced a lot of the hospitals to push for early discharge of the wounded over the weekend, because we felt that the health system was very exposed with all of these injured people in the beds, and we felt that there's going to be another wave. And unfortunately, this came true this morning, that we needed to discharge a lot of the wounded early. Well, you need to realize this comes at the at the end of a 4-year economic crisis that has really disabled the Lebanese health system and disabled the Lebanese government in terms of its ability to support the Ministry of Health. So you have around a third of the doctors and nurses emigrated as a result of the collapse of the Lebanese currency. And you have a health system that's mainly made up of small and medium-sized private institutions that, you know, just don't have the purchasing capacity to buy the kind of medication, the consumables that they need. And those who did, it was used up on Tuesday treating, and since then treating the 3,000 wounded.
You worked for weeks in Gaza, treating the wounded, the injured there. How does what you're seeing here in Beirut compare? You told the New York Times the Lebanese health system is in no way able to treat war wounded. If it were to escalate into a full-blown war, we're stuck in this loop. You just operate and operate. You feel like you're playing catch-up all the time, Dr. Abusetha.
So when we had these 3,000 wounded all within a couple of hours of each other, they flooded the health system, which then meant that they were being taken to the operating room. Really, I mean, this is the biggest hospital in Lebanon, the American University of Beirut Medical Center. And we had 10 rooms going all the time. We were doing around 50 to 60 cases per day. And it took us from Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, till Saturday to finish the majority of the initial surgeries. I mean, these patients, especially for their hand reconstruction, will need between 5 and 12 surgeries over the next 5 years to regain some hand function, to try to limit the disability that's left. The eyes, that's the even more devastating thing. The eyes, the loss of vision as a result of these injuries. That's going to leave permanent disability. This is an act of kind of almost mythical mutilation. It's an act of mutilation, it was not an assassination attempt, but an act of mass mutilation.
Dr. Hassan Abusetha, we want to thank you for being with us. My final question is, you moved to Beirut in 2011, joined the faculty of the American University of Beirut Hospital. Your mother was born in Lebanon. Why did you choose to go back?
On Tuesday, I realized when I was in London, I had been in Glasgow as the rector, speaking at the opening ceremony of the academic year, and then went back to London. And as the news came about on Tuesday morning and Tuesday afternoon, I realized the sheer number and the type of injuries would require a reconstructive surgery. And so that was the decision. I took an overnight flight from London on Tuesday night and got here at 8 o'clock on Wednesday morning and came straight to the hospital. And we have literally been operating since then. We're now trying to clear the hospital with the news of over 500 now wounded in the south. And we're expecting these wounded, some of whom to come here, the most critically wounded. The Israelis have been targeting cars on the roads full of fleeing families. And so we need, you know, I think the most important thing is that the humanitarian sector needs to realize that the Lebanese health system now needs help before the Israelis bomb the airport. It needs trauma teams to be brought in. It needs them to be fully equipped and fully funded in terms of consumables and medication, because the system is not going to be able to deal with this.
I want to thank you for being with us, Dr. Hassan Abusetha, British-Palestinian surgeon, speaking to us from Beirut, and Cynthia Issa, editor-at-large at The Public Source, also in Beirut, Lebanon. When we come back, press freedom groups are condemning the Israeli military for raiding and shutting down Al Jazeera's main West Bank office in Ramallah. The raid was broadcast live on television. We'll speak with Al Jazeera's managing editor. Stay with us. Little One by Marcel Khalife and Umayma El Khalil. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Press freedom groups are condemning the Israeli military for raiding and shutting down Al Jazeera's Ramallah office in the occupied West Bank. The raid was broadcast live on TV Sunday morning. Heavily armed Israeli troops were seen entering the office and confiscating equipment while ordering the office closed for at least 45 days. This is an Israeli soldier confronting Al Jazeera's West Bank bureau chief, Waleed Al-Omari.
Good evening. There's an order from the court to shut down Al Jazeera for 45 days. I ask you to take all the cameras and leave the office now.
Should we all leave?
This is an order.
Can I see it, please? This is the order which was brought to us by this office and his military forces. The order says that it is an order to shut down the office of Al Jazeera channel for 45 days. And this is a military decision from the commander of the central area and the Israeli military. It asks us to leave this office immediately and to take our personal belongings and our cameras.
During the raid, Israeli troops also tore down a poster of Shireen Abu Akleh, the Al Jazeera journalist, the Palestinian-American, who was fatally shot by Israeli troops May 11th, 2022, when she was outside the Jenin refugee camp. Reporters Without Borders responded to this weekend's raid with a statement denouncing, quote, Israel's relentless assault, unquote, and repeating its call for the repeal of the Israeli law that allows the government to shut down foreign media. UN Secretary General spokesperson Stephane Dujarric said Sunday the UN's deeply concerned about Israel's closure of Al Jazeera's offices in the occupied West Bank.
We're very concerned anytime, anywhere in the world, media offices get closed, especially in conflict areas. The journalists are the eyes and ears of the world, and they need to be able to do their job free from harassment or any other type of impediment.
For more, we go to Doha, where we're joined by Mohammed Mouawad, managing editor of Al Jazeera. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you lay out exactly what happened on Sunday morning, Mohammed?
Thank you, Sammy, for having me. It's glad to be back with you. When we spoke, when we last spoke in May, when the Israeli government took the decision of shutting down our offices in Jerusalem and the Palestinian and the Tel Aviv, I told you that the situation is ambiguous and the law itself upon which the Israeli government took the decision is ambiguous as well. It could be weaponized against us anytime when the Israeli government feel that the intimidation, a step of intimidation, isn't enough. They can go further, escalate the intimidation process. So that's exactly what happened. Our bureau chief, Waleed Al-Omari, was live on air, reporting on the exchange of strikes in Lebanon between Hezbollah and the Israeli forces. Suddenly, the Israeli soldiers, these were not ordinary officers, but rather, a fully equipped and ready for combat zone officers and soldiers. And they invaded the office, and they spoke to Waleed Al-Omari, who stood very strong against them, defending his right for freedom of the press. And he told them, why you are here? This is not a combat zone. This is a space for journalism. They said that there is an order to shut down the office. And that's a win that the whole situation was shilling for us because, you know, this is a dedicated space for journalism. This is an office for reporters, for journalists. This is not a combat zone. They then went on to move from corner to corner in the office as if it's a combat zone. And then they tore down our late colleague Shirin Abu Akla's picture from the wall. They stole all equipments from inside the office, despite the fact that the order itself it was handed to Waleed Al-Omari did not mention anything about equipments. And then they went farther to follow our colleagues downstairs where they continued reporting about the incident. And they took the mic from Waleed Al-Omari and said, you're not allowed to work here. Go home. But, you know, the whole situation here is not shutting down an office. It's not a decision by the Israeli government that was executed by the army, a fully equipped army, but rather an invasion to the very principle of the press freedom around the world.
Can you explain how the Israeli military has jurisdiction here? Your Ramallah Bureau, which is in charge of the whole West Bank coverage of Al Jazeera, is an Area A, an area marked as being under Palestinian control in the Oslo Accords. So what legal jurisdiction did Israel have to come in with their heavily armed soldiers?
This is why, Amy, it's very difficult for us to find a way to challenge this legally, because really, the whole situation is ambiguous. They say this is emergency law. This is according to the defense minister of Israel, an order by him to the army to enter the West Bank and shut down an office, which does not, does not include the power of the Israeli army in this area, because it's an area that is under the jurisdiction A, which is mainly for the Palestinian Authority to decide about. But you know, the whole Israel has no right to kill over 160 journalists in Gaza. I mean, and they've done it, and they continue to do it. They've killed three colleagues at Al Jazeera. They continue to commit atrocities against journalists. So it wasn't surprising. By the way, it was the least decision, the least action they have taken against us because we've lost colleagues. But at the same time, it was a show of force, a show of, intimidation to show journalists around the globe that what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank isn't allowed to be reported about, and that the coverage of Al Jazeera is an enemy for the Israeli government, despite the fact that we haven't and we're not weaponizing at all. And we're not going to do that. We're not weaponizing our platform, despite the fact that we are being intimidated. We have lost the colleagues. Just before I come on air, we've been airing the Israeli forces press conference, and We continue to do that, despite the fact that the Israeli government shut down our offices in Israel and the Palestinian territories to try to delegitimize our coverage and say that Al Jazeera is a one-sided coverage. You don't operate there. But we continue to cover. We continue to make sure that we give voice to the voiceless, and at the same time make sure that it's both narratives kind of coverage.
One of the things you do on Al Jazeera when reporters are reporting on Israel, since you're banned from Israel, is repeatedly say that. That's unlike U.S. networks that don't say when they're reporting on Gaza that the Israeli military prevents them from going into Gaza. Talk about that editorial decision that you've made as you have reporters in Amman and other places saying, we are not allowed to be in Israel as we report this right now, and what these images mean that you're broadcasting that others don't.
This is exactly what we should be talking about, Amy. Shutting down our Al Jazeera's office is the headline, but the name of the game is preventing journalists from doing their job, either in Gaza, in the West Bank. They want us to report remotely. They don't want us to be in the front lines. And that's crystal clear. I mean, the whole international journalistic community should be talking about one topic when they see a journalist killed in Gaza. They should be talking about one topic when they see an office shut down in Gaza or in West Bank or in Israel. The one topic is no international journalist was allowed to enter Gaza to cover the war there, to give voice to the voiceless, which is at the core of this and the principle, the main principle of this profession. We know international journalists, even the international journalistic community is not placing pressure on Israel to allow their colleagues to get into Gaza to cover. Remember the Arab Spring when so many American and Western journalists challenged the bureaucracy of the authoritarian regimes to go cover from Tahrir Square or from Tunisia or from Syria or from Libya. Right now, no one is placing that pressure. And it's really, really annoying because we should be defending the freedom of the press. We should be defending the right to know what's happening there. We should not be shy from what's happening in Gaza and be part of this concealing that the Israeli government is trying to do to conceal what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank and the atrocities being committed. They just want us to report remotely, and we will continue to remind the world and the journalistic community that this is happening and that you should unite to place pressure on the Israeli government to give the right for journalists to enter Gaza, even after a possible ceasefire. This should be the case to uncover what's really happened there. I remind you that we still have 6 correspondents reporting from Gaza, and that's something that we are committed to. We are committed to give voice to the voiceless. An office is nothing for us. We will continue the coverage. We asked our colleagues to stay safe in the West Bank right now until we figure out the legal procedure, because as I told you, Amy, the situation is ambiguous. We can't really know on what basis that decision was taken, but we expected it.
Mohammed Amoawad, I want to thank you for being with us. Managing editor of Al Jazeera, speaking to us from Al Jazeera's headquarters in Doha, Qatar. Next up, as Georgia's pro-Trump state election board voted Friday to require hand counting of all ballots in the November election, we'll speak with an election board member who voted against the rule change back in 20 seconds.
I never seen a real rainbow. I still believe, though. Gotta believe, though. It hurts me when people are fighting. Different street sides. Words cut like sharp knives. But it doesn't have to be that way. I will not believe that I'm the only one who has that dream. No, it doesn't have to be that way. What will it take to make you believe the change is coming?
Change is coming, Rubia Manfu. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With just about 40 days until the presidential election, Georgia's state election board voted 3-2 to approve a controversial new rule that'll require counties to hand count the ballots cast election night, which could delay the reporting of results in the key battleground state, and that means for the nation. The proposal was spearheaded by the board's pro-Trump majority, will require the hand count in addition to the customary machine count in each of Georgia's precincts. Trump praised the electoral board members last month as pit bulls fighting for honesty, transparency and victory. For more, we're joined by 2 guests. We're going to start with Sarah Tyndall-Gazelle, a member of the Georgia State Election Board who opposed the measure. She's also an election law attorney. Welcome to Democracy Now! I know you just have a minute. Can you explain how this vote took place and what it means?
Certainly. We received a petition from a member of the public who is a well-known election denier a few months ago that would require the counties to hand count the ballots. Now, this is not a tabulation. This is simply counting the number of ballots that were scanned on the day of the election. We have another one that would have applied to early voting. That one, fortunately, did not pass. Rather than using the normal rulemaking procedures of working together, having the board draft the rules, this was one of dozens of petitions that came from election deniers, and they're motivated by people who believe the 2020 election was stolen. Now, mind you, there are multiple cross-checks on the number of ballots that that got scanned through. There's a counter on the tabulator. The tabulator tapes have the number of ballots cast. The number of voters who checked in are already going to be cross-checked with the number of ballots printed and the ballots scanned. But this adds, at really the 11th hour, another layer of confusion, because the counties have already hired all their poll workers. They've trained their poll workers, and they will have been working for 14 hours. And now they have to hand count stacks of ballots that are, it's not like they're neatly stacked like ream of paper. They're all going to be, they have to pull them out of the scanners, and rather than seal them up with a numbered seal that is a security seal, now they have to stack them up, count them three times, not just once, not twice, three times. If there's a single discrepancy, they have to start over again. And one of the arguments that my fellow board members made was, well, why are you sacrificing accuracy for speed? That is a policy choice that the legislature made 2-3 years ago when they passed the laws that had very strict reporting deadlines, which are now at risk of being violated. The counties are being set up for failure. But to me, one of the most troubling aspects of this whole thing is we were told by our attorneys, the state attorney general, that we don't have the legal authority to even do this, that this is untethered to statute. And yet my colleagues decided to go ahead and pass a rule that they don't have the legal authority to pass, according to the attorney general's office. That, to me, is the most troubling part of this.
I know you're rushing to get to the election board meeting. What do you expect to come out of it? And what's it like to be the only Democrat on this election board?
Sometimes it can be pretty lonely. I have to be willing to be the unwelcome voice. It's not just that I'm the only Democrat. I'm also the only attorney, and apparently the only one aside from the chairman who feels constrained by the rule of law. Today, we're looking at more issues that we don't have jurisdiction to be looking at. So it's not going to be a fun morning for me.
And can this count? Delay the national count for who is elected president of the United States?
Unfortunately, there is every chance that because the counties will not, some counties will not be able to transport those memory cards with the vote totals back to their headquarters to be uploaded for the rest of the nation to see until this hand count has been completed.
Sarah Tyndall-Gazelle, I want to thank you for being with us, a member of the Georgia State Election Board, the only election law attorney on that five-person board. In 2020, Georgia was at the center of Trump's false claims of election fraud as he attempted to overturn his election loss to Biden. Trump at the time told the told Georgia's Raffensperger in a phone call, quote, "I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have because we won the state." Georgia's Secretary of State Raffensperger refused, but many warn Trump is now laying the groundwork for another attempt at manipulating and undermining voting results in Georgia this November. Democratic Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock said Trump supporters are, quote, "trying to set up a scenario in which they could refuse to certify an election whose results they don't like." This comes as Trump allies in Nebraska are ramping up efforts to change the state's electoral college process to grant all votes to the statewide winner. Nebraska and Maine are the only states that split their electoral votes by congressional district. Meanwhile, in Arizona, the state Supreme Court ruled Friday nearly 98,000 people whose citizenship documents hadn't been confirmed can vote in state and local races. For all of this, we're joined by Ari Berman, voting rights correspondent, Mother Jones Magazine. Talk about the significance of Georgia and then just race through everything else, if you will, Ari.
Well, what Republicans are trying to do, Amy, is to, at the 11th hour, rig the voting rules to benefit their side in a really unprecedented way. In Georgia, they're laying the groundwork not to certify the election if Kamala Harris wins the state through a series of rule changes that the Trump-aligned election board have made. In Nebraska, they are trying to quite literally rig the Electoral College so that Trump wins or there's a tie and the election gets thrown to the House of Representatives, because the fact is that the Electoral College is already biased towards Trump because it favors small states and wider, more Republican battleground states. But they want to shift this one district in Omaha that could vote for Harris. They want to shift it back towards Trump so that either Trump wins, or if Harris wins the blue wall of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, the election could be tied. There could be no majority in the Electoral College. The election would then be thrown to the House, where a majority of state House delegations, not state members overall, would choose the president. And that would be an incredibly undemocratic scenario in which a candidate who lost the popular vote, who did not win the Electoral College, could still be installed as president by House Republicans who would have the power to do so through gerrymandering and other manipulations of the democratic process.
And Maine?
It's too late for Maine to fight back. That is the problem. Maine also is one of two states that splits up its Electoral College votes, but Maine has to pass these kind of changes 90 days before the election, or they need a two-thirds supermajority in the legislature to do it, which they don't have. So right now, I think the problem is it feels like the Trump side is doing everything they can to manipulate the rules, and Democrats don't have the same ability to fight back. And Trump side may have indeed waited in Nebraska for Maine to be unable to retaliate in order to put this 11th hour change to the Electoral College through.
And Arizona, Ari Berman.
So what happened in Arizona was the Supreme Court very late in the day said that people who don't show proof of citizenship when they register to vote can only vote in federal races, not state races. There were 100,000 ballots that were at issue in terms of people who the state claimed did not have this proof of citizenship. But the Arizona Supreme Court said that they actually can cast both federal and state ballots. And the interesting thing is these voters who supposedly lacked proof of citizenship, they were disproportionately likely to be Republicans. So it just goes to show you that when you try to suppress voting rights, and they're trying to suppress the voting rights of Democrats and voters of color, there can also be collateral damage that hurts Republicans as well.
And finally, go back to Georgia, where we began, and the overall significance of this for the federal election.
What's happening in Georgia is incredibly disturbing because the MAGA-aligned election board, really at the 11th hour, is passing not one, not two, but three or more rule changes that could lead Republican county boards not to certify the election if a Democrat wins. That could plunge the state into chaos. Trump could then weaponize that disinformation. There's a lot of unpredictable outcomes there. That could also delay the counting of votes, which could send the election to the House. So right now, we're just witnessing all of these really disturbing efforts very late in the game to try to manipulate the democratic process to Republicans' benefits. And they're basically using all the tools they have to essentially rerun the 2020 playbook to try to steal the election. But this time, they're running it before the election.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you for being with us, voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link to your articles. Happy belated birthday to Jackie Sam. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week, I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Hello. This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.